Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
In lean economic times, we look to a leader. There's President Obama, but he's so busy with more than the economy. He's also hemmed in by politics, and so is his Treasury Secretary, which leads us to Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke. He's got a big speech tomorrow, but how much can a central banker really do? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Ally Bank, committed to customer service with the option to reach a human being at any time at 877-247-ALLY by pressing zero.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Bill Radke, in for Kai Rizdahl. It is Thursday, August 26th. Thank you for tuning in. The business world's gaze will be on Federal Reserve Chair Ben Bernanke tomorrow when he gives his economic outlook at the annual Fed Symposium in Jackson Hole, Wyoming. Now, we don't know what he's going to say, but he is sure not the only one talking. He has 12 regional Federal Reserve Bank presidents all venting different opinions about what he should do. Here to talk about all that dissension, and at her own opinion, is senior economist at the Bank of Tokyo Mitsubishi, Ellen Zettner. Welcome to Marketplace.
Thank you.
Let's start with the dissension. I have heard more about regional Federal Reserve presidents this summer than I have heard in my entire life. The head of the Kansas City Fed says the biggest risk is inflation. The one in St. Louis says, no, it's deflation. What is all that division telling us?
Well, it tells us that confusion reigns the day. And because of that, markets are pretty confused right now, too. You always want the Fed to act with one voice. It always gives markets much more confidence in the direction the Fed is taking. Not only did we come through an unprecedented, nearly unprecedented economic downturn, but the Fed has had to do some unprecedented things in order to try and get the economy moving again. And so it's only natural that when they're sort of shooting in the dark here, that there's going to be some dissension within the Fed of how monetary policy should be conducted.
Most of my life, it seemed like there was just Alan Greenspan. Amen.
Now it's Bernanke et al. Chairman Bernanke has come out and specifically said that one of the further measures that they could do to get the economy moving was lowering that rate that they pay on excess reserves. That's the rate that they pay banks in order to hold excess reserves at the Federal Reserve. That by lowering that rate, the idea would be that the banks would then start to lend money. St. Louis Fed President Bullard came out and said absolutely not, that that's a dead-end policy and that it won't work. But at the same time, I have to agree with Bullard, because right now there's just disincentive for banks to lend when the banks can borrow from the Fed at 0.25% interest and dump it into treasuries at 2.5% to 3%. They get a nice, tidy gain, risk-free return. And essentially, it's been tying up about $1 trillion in available credit. So in a sense, the Fed has been causing part of the problem by leaving rates so low.
You talked about the importance of projecting confidence, of speaking with one voice. Should Bernanke be shushing his regional presidents?
Absolutely not. And he might play it as it's important to have these discussions where everyone gives their opinion so that everyone's looking at the issues from each angle. It's unfortunate that there's dissension, but it doesn't necessarily have to mean that the Fed can't come to some group decision.
What do you want to hear from Ben Bernanke tomorrow?
Well, I'd like to hear him talk about just what are the concerns for the economic outlook. I like it that the Fed is being more realistic about the risk to the economic outlook, and I think Ben Bernanke is going to have to address that.
Ellen Zettner is senior economist at the Bank of Tokyo Mitsubishi. Ellen, thank you.
Thank you.
On Wall Street today, the Dow lost a digit. It's back under 10,000. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. So we were talking about the Federal Reserve there. You know, the really low interest rates that Ben Bernanke is supporting, they are a useful tool for propping up the economy. But for consumers, man, they're a double-edged sword. I mean, if you have a savings account, you know what I'm talking about. Thanks a lot, bank. Thanks for the 8-cent interest I just got on my $1,000. Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson reports the whole idea of a savings account, it's lost some of its appeal.
I guess any account where you don't lose money is a good thing in this economy. But the mattress is starting to look pretty appealing. The average interest rate for a savings account is now less than 1%. And Mike Mebs with the economic research firm Mebs Services says while banks have long had required minimums for savings account balances,
now they're starting to enforce those minimums and also to have fees for falling below those minimums.
That's in part because banks can borrow money so cheaply from the government right now that a high-maintenance customer who only saves a little and does a lot of transactions just isn't worth it anymore.
If you're planning on having a $100 or $200 savings account, good luck in trying to find somebody that's not going to eventually charge you a fee for that because they just can't afford to have those accounts anymore.
But before you rush over to your local bank to take all your money out, Mickey Cargyle with WNB Private Client Services says remember that savings accounts also serve another purpose.
The savings account fills a role in that that's your rainy day money. And by segregating the money from your checking account, it helps keep you from spending it.
And Cargyle advises his clients to keep 6 months of living expenses in a rainy day fund. He says when interest rates start heading back up, savings accounts will become more profitable for consumers again. That is, if those bank fees don't eat up all the money first. In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
So, low interest rates are a drag if you're a saver, but if you're a home buyer, well, then you're ecstatic. Today, mortgage rates again fell to the lowest level on record, 4.36% for a 30-year fixed. Now, homeowners have reacted to that. Refinances are booming, but home sales, they've barely budged. Now, think about that for a second. You've heard the economists saying that home buying stalled because the $8,000 federal tax credit for first-time home buyers ran out in April. We lost this big buying incentive. But what about those low interest rates? Those would save you way more money than an $8,000 tax credit. So why aren't the rock-bottom rates lighting a home buying fire? We asked Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer to solve that riddle.
Take today's low mortgage rates and compare them to where rates were in April. If you bought now, you could eventually save about $27,000, more than three times the value of the tax credit. But homebuyers apparently haven't been swayed by that math. And Greg McBride of Bankrate.com says that's because buyers are impatient. The tax credit was immediate. The long-term savings is not.
If I say to you, Nancy, I'll give you $100 now, or I'll give you $10 a month for the next 10 months. Which one would you rather have?
I'd take the $100 now, of course. The other reason low mortgage rates aren't as appealing as the tax credit, you'd have to stay in the same house for 30 years to get the full savings. Most people only own a home for 7 years. But there's another reason people aren't tempted by the low mortgage rates. They're spooked by the high unemployment rate. Anthony Sanders teaches real estate finance at George Mason University.
It's just not the size of the mortgage payment. It's whether you're going to keep your job. That is the big 800-pound gorilla in the room.
With that big hairy gorilla hanging around, no one's going bananas over low mortgage rates. But even if you are tempted, it's not easy to get a loan now. Chris Mayer teaches real estate at Columbia Business School.
Anybody who's been unemployed probably got behind in some bill at some point in that process. And their credit score got hit, and that is going to make it a lot harder for them to get a mortgage.
Plus, banks are demanding higher down payments, also a tall order in a tough economy. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Here's something we don't say often enough. Some shopping malls around the country will soon get a major new tenant. Now, this name will not be much of a draw for cruising teenagers. Marketplace's Adrian Hill reports it's the parents that malls are hoping to attract with Costco.
Half-occupied malls have got to be among the most depressing places.
It's hard to want to spend money on a new pair of shoes when empty stores are there to remind you that the economy is in trouble. Analysts say Costco's move into malls makes sense for mall owners that need anchor tenants and Costco that needs space.
Real estate is a lot harder to get today than it has been at any time in the past.
Retail analyst Patty Edwards is with Storehouse Partners. She says especially in dense markets, it's been tough for Costco to find land and get the permits it needs to open new stores. At the same time, malls and their department stores have had some tough years.
Every time another retailer reports, it's almost like the line from It's a Wonderful Life. Every time you hear a bell ring, an angel gets its wings. Every time you hear a retail company report their earnings, they're telling us that they're closing more stores.
Neil Stern is a senior partner at McMillan Doolittle. He says there aren't a lot of retailers out there that can fill major mall space.
Because of places like Costco, people have been coming to malls less. So it's a bit of a, you know, if you can't beat them, join them strategy, perhaps.
He's guessing that other retail stores in the malls could benefit from the traffic Costco brings in. Plus, Stern says Costco shoppers are exactly the sort of shoppers that retailers drool over.
They're generally high income. They're working. They have large families.
The real question is whether those shoppers, after loading up at Costco on toilet paper, frozen steaks, and laundry detergent, will have the energy or the money to keep on shopping. I'm Adrienne Hill for Marketplace.
More and more businesses are trying to get consumers to spend by turning to this online marketing phenom called Groupon. Have you heard about this? Millions of members around the world get huge discount offers in their email every day. Last week, Groupon offered a half-off coupon at The Gap, the first time it ever featured a national retailer, and 500,000 people clicked buy and they temporarily crashed Groupon servers. The company's CEO says more promotions with big chains are on the way for the holiday season. Now, when you're The Gap, you can handle 500,000 new customers in a day. But being Groupon's pick of the day can be a whole other story for a small merchant. From the entrepreneurship desk at Oregon Public Broadcasting, Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reports.
Here's how this works. Every day, Groupon offers a different discount coupon in each city where it operates. This week in Portland, I could have bought a month of yoga aerobics for $35. That's 75% off. Or I could have gotten some very cheap tattoos. The vendor is typically a neighborhood business trolling for new customers. Dara Levy offered an introductory facial at her Chicago spa recently.
It's triple exfoliation, a scalpel-like tool. It's really just a sharp razor.
Not for me, but she says women love it. What Levy loved were the 1,300 potential new customers Groupon sent her way.
You see through a ticker how many Groupons are sold by the minute, and people catch the fever and get on board. And it's scary at first because your phone is literally ringing off the hook.
Groupon would have let Levy cap how many facials she sold, though she decided to take the risk of an unlimited sale. Now she's had to hire an extra esthetician, and she's still trying to schedule all the new clients. I spoke to one tour operator who sold 1,000 coupons in a single day. Now he has irate customers who want to go out next weekend. He can't schedule them for months. Making customers wait, even for something they bought at a big discount, can backfire. Philadelphia resident Thea Gallus used an online coupon service called Living Social, its a rival to Groupon, to buy a half-off ticket to an international beer festival this summer. Then she had to cool her heels for a drink.
There was a separate line, so we had a much longer wait than the people that had normal tickets.
Gallus says she isn't likely to go to the beer festival again or buy any service on Groupon, such as house cleaning, that she has to wait to schedule. But she likes offers like the one from The Gap.
That was one that definitely appealed to me. It could be something that's on your terms instead of having to schedule it with someone.
But there are consumers who are turned off by Groupon's ever-growing mob effect.
Right now, I don't buy Groupon.
Farhad Ghafarzada of Portland says he doesn't want to compete with bargain-hunting Groupon groupies who can inundate a small shop. But get this, back in March, Ghafarzada himself offered an incredibly successful Groupon deal for his own business, an eco-friendly auto garage. He'd just opened up and suddenly had 700 new customers coming in for an oil change.
We discounted it from $40 down to $15.
Groupon took half of that as its cut, leaving the garage with just $750, a big loss. Ghafarzada says it was definitely worth it for the PR. Groupon spokeswoman Julie Mosler.
We never position Groupon as a way to make money. To us, it's about driving traffic in through the doors.
But if a business doesn't convert that into repeat traffic or drives consumers away with long delays, it can be hard to recover from the Groupon experience. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Coming up, you too can be a patron of the arts.
We'll start an investment club, but get people to contribute to composers.
But first, let's do the numbers. Well, so much for 10,000. The Dow Jones Industrial Average sank 74 points today, about 0.75%, and the result was 99.85, the first close for the Dow below 10K in more than a month. The NASDAQ lost 22 points, more than 1%, to settle at 21.18, and the S&P 500 gave back 8 points, more than 0.75%, to wrap at 10.47. HP outbid Dell in their buyout war for data storage company 3PAR. HP's shares were off a tiny fraction. Dell dipped 0.33%. 3PAR shares withered nearly 3%. Shares of American Airlines coasted 0.8% lower after federal regulators docked the company more than $24 million. The fine stems from maintenance violations that grounded thousands of flights 2 years ago. Bonds rose today. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.48%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Progressive Insurance, helping people shop for car insurance at 1-800-PROGRESSIVE and progressive.com. By Yellow Book 360, offering a spectrum of marketing tools for small businesses designed to go beyond yellow. More at yellowbook360.com. And by Mass Mutual, offering Save the Game, a financial literacy app for children designed for iPod Touch and iPhone, available on the App Store. If you missed the broadcast, you can still catch Marketplace. Go to our website and click on podcasts. You'll find Marketplace, The Morning Report, Marketplace Money, and more, all at marketplace.org.
State Book, here's a look at events coming up Friday. In Washington, the Commerce Department releases its second estimate gross domestic product report for the second quarter. All eyes and ears are on Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke. He'll be in Jackson Hole, Wyoming, talking about the economic outlook. And on August 27, 2005, Mayor Ray Nagin declared a state of emergency as New Orleans residents hit the highway or braced for Hurricane Katrina. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Bill Radke in for Kai Rizdahl. What would you do if somebody came up to you on the street and handed you a $100 bill? If you live in the Detroit area, this is not a purely hypothetical question. There is a group handing out hundreds to 100 people, randomly selected, and this will go on for 100 days. The campaign, appropriately, is called Project 100. It's backed by a local credit union. And a marketer named Greg Waller helped come up with the idea. He's with the Edge Creative Group near Detroit. Greg, welcome.
Thank you very much.
You started this project last year, and obviously it's been good publicity for the credit union sponsoring you. But beyond that, why this project? Why did you want to hand out money?
In the Detroit market, which is where this began, things have been pretty difficult. A lot of people losing jobs. So the credit union came to us, and they wanted us to try and come up with a way that they can give back to their members. So what we did was we came up with an idea where we could touch a small number of people, and hopefully those people could touch a far greater number of people and help impact the general situation here locally by getting people more interested in giving within their local communities.
In that moment, how do people react when you hand them $100?
It's an amazing feeling to see people and see how they react. We've had people break down in tears. We had one woman last summer who told us that day they were going to shut her gas off and she was going to use this money to make sure that it's not shut off and pay some of the bills. So we've had people in shock.
I hate to say it, I think I might be suspicious. I think that might be my reaction. Counterfeit.
That's funny. We've had people who have actually turned it down.
That was going a little farther than I was. I just figured I'd have a useless piece of paper, but there are people who just say, I don't want any part of this?
Oh, yeah. We've had people who literally will not accept the money and walk away. And, you know, I mean, I guess I understand that. I mean, in, you know, working with financial institutions like we do, we see all sorts of scams all the time. So I could understand how people would be skeptical. Most people are skeptical at least a little bit, but then when they hear the story and they understand what's going on, I think they start to warm up to it, and we walk away and say no strings attached, and that's it.
And do you make them tell you what they're going to do with it?
No, you know, what we found is that most people are pretty shocked and don't really know immediately what they're going to do with it, but we give them some contact information to go to the website, and there's an area where they can share their stories. Quite often, they don't know right off the bat. It usually takes them maybe a few days to figure out exactly what they're going to do.
Tell me one story that really stands out to you.
We were just in a neighborhood, and we really didn't see anybody out walking around, so we decided to go up and just knock on a few doors. And we knocked on this gentleman's door, and he came to the front, presented him with $100, and his response was, you know, this is great. I love it. It's fantastic. But I don't particularly need the $100 right now, but I do know someone who does. Would you come with me? And the whole team of us walked across the street to an elderly gentleman's house. This gentleman had just gotten done having surgery and that he was having money problems, and he knocked on the door. When the guy came to the door, he literally handed him the $100 bill and said, you know, this is what these people gave to me, and I want to give it to you. And, you know, I can just tell you, I mean, that's one story of many stories just like that. It's amazing, you know, how many people have been touched by this.
Greg Woller is with the marketing company Edge Creative Group near Detroit, and he's working on the Project 100 campaign to give away 100 100s to random people in the Detroit area. Greg, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And it's not just Detroit feeling the love either. Project 100 has already spread to other credit unions in Michigan, California, and Texas. I know a lot of public radio listeners are patrons of the arts. We support the arts with our time and our dollars. But when was the last time you not only bought a ticket for the theater, but actually commissioned a new play or a new symphony? Not wealthy enough for that, you say? Well, Marketplace's Jeff Tyler found out you don't have to be filthy rich to leave an artistic legacy.
Charlie Stadiker doesn't exactly hide his affection for his wife, Benita. For their 25th wedding anniversary, he commissioned this. It's a trombone concerto by the Seattle Symphony's composer-in-residence, Samuel Jones. The price tag, $30,000. Charlie Stadiker is in commercial real estate. He wanted to commission more artworks, but couldn't afford it.
With the downturn in the real estate market, we ran out of money.
So Stadiker found partners. Four other couples are sharing the cost of a new concerto, $8,000 per couple, payable over 2 years. When you break it down, it comes to a little more than $300 a month.
You don't have to be a Vanderbilt or a de Medici to fund a new work of art that can be equal to or even less than your monthly car payment.
Commissioning clubs have been around for decades. Many people credit Jack and Linda Heschler, a couple from St. Paul, Minnesota, for creating the model.
Many people for years had complimented us on the fact that we were commissioning new music, and they'd say, well, how do you do it? And we would tell them, and nobody would ever do it.
Then one night, about 20 years ago, they had an epiphany.
We'll start an investment club, but get people to contribute to composers.
The Heschlers got other couples to join this investment club. They've funded 18 new works so far, more than half of them by composer Stephen Paulus. Heschler says each couple ponies up $3,000 a year.
It's an amount of money we probably all, unfortunately, waste in the year, maybe eating out more than we should.
For people on a tighter budget, some clubs, like the People's Commissioning Fund, accept donations of almost any size. It funds more contemporary avant-garde stuff, like this work by composer Ken Thompson. In many commissioning clubs, funders get extra perks. Gerard Schwartz is musical director at the Seattle Symphony.
the commissioners also get to come to all the rehearsals. They get to come to the premiere performance. If we record it, they get credit for that. For the life of the work, it will be associated with these people.
A few years ago, Charlie Stadiker commissioned a new play for his wife, Benita. It's being staged this month at the Pacific Resident Theater in Venice, California. Before Act One starts, artistic director Marilyn Fox tells the audience about Charlie.
He wanted to give her a 60th birthday gift. So he commissioned, as they did in Shakespeare's day, a work of art. And he had no promise of anything but a reading.
The play got more than a reading. The comedy, Becky's New Car, has been a commercial success.
He didn't even do the one thing that I asked him, which was to get the dishwasher loaded. My son was loaded and the dishwasher was not.
The play's been selling out regional theaters in 10 cities. Stadiker couldn't be more proud.
It's probably the best investment that I have ever made.
He says funding a new play or a new symphony comes down to a matter of priorities.
Instead of taking a safari to Africa or a European cruise or buying a new car, you can take the same amount of money and make an investment in a work of art that will last generations.
It will be months before Stadiker hears his latest investment. The concerto funded by his commissioning club will debut next summer. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
Is supported by Putnam Investments, offering long-term strategies built on experience and research on the web at putnam.com/largecapequity. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
And this final note, New Jersey says it made an honest mistake, and will the federal government please send more money? It seems a state bureaucrat was filling out the application form for the Race to the Top education program, and the form asked for budget information comparing the 2008 school year with 09, but he or she entered data for 2010 and 11. New Jersey's education commissioner says the mistake cost his state $400 million in federal help, but he's not asking for all of that back, just $75 million. Even that small gesture of understanding would go a long way toward teaching New Jersey's children the importance of reading, writing, and arithmetic, especially arithmetic. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow lost 74 points, 0.75%, back below 10,000. NASDAQ dipped 22 points, more than 1%. S&P 500 gave back 8 points, more than 0.75%. John Buckley, Stephen Gregory, John Haas, Patty Hirsch, Betsy Streisand, and Lisa Tucker are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is George Judson. Tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news. Next time on this show, we talk about housing woes, but when hurricanes displace people, available housing goes like hotcakes.
The decision to buy or sell a home is one of the more major decisions that you have to make in life. These people are having to make it in 5 or 10 minutes.
I'm Bill Radke. I do hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.